I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. Early this morning, heavily armed police raided an apartment in Saint-Denis outside of Paris, looking for Abdelhamid Aboud, the man they believe organized the terror attack in Paris on Friday night that killed 129 people and wounded many more. Two people died this morning, including a woman who blew herself up with an explosive vest. Seven were arrested. This is the latest development in the hunt for those responsible for the attacks and their accomplices. We asked Malcolm Nance to join us. He's executive director of the Terror Asymmetrics Project on Strategy, Tactics, and Radical Ideologies, also known as Tapestry. He's a counterterrorism and intelligence consultant, former Navy special intelligence operator, wrote a book called The Terrorist Recognition Handbook, and he's got a forthcoming book called Defeating ISIS. And Malcolm Nance, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here, although the circumstances aren't the greatest.
Absolutely, not the greatest at all. In fact, a very worrisome, very troublesome. What kind of planning went into this attack?
Well, the very nature of this terrorist attack is what we call a directional attack. This wasn't inspirational. They weren't inspired. They just didn't self-start. It appears that Mr. Aboud, who was the terrorist planner, who went over to Syria years ago, a few years ago, in 2013, managed to get a group of men.
We are going to reconnect with our guest. We had him by Skype, but obviously that did not work. So again, we are talking, frankly, getting an update on the terror attack of Friday night in Paris. And talking to Malcolm Nance, he's a former Navy special intelligence operator. He's going to fill us in on the investigation, what investigators are looking for, why some young people are attracted to the murderous and apocalyptic ideology of ISIS, a question I think we all want answers to. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We also have a guest who will be joining us in about half an hour. He's Jonathan Lawrence, Associate Professor of Political Science at Boston College. He's a non-resident senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. He's also the author of a book called The Emancipation of Europe's Muslims. And we do want to talk about with him about the relationship between Muslims and France in particular. Looks like we have Malcolm Nance back on the telephone, I guess. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, you'll have to forgive the loss of communications. But as I was saying, this mission was operational. This is one that was directional. This means that all the indications are that it was planned in Syria, and the man who apparently was the, I don't like to use the term mastermind, I like to use the term operational commander on the ground, or as ISIS likes to call them, the emir of this mission, Mr. Abdelhamid Aboud from Belgium, planned this mission, got trained operatives who were of French origin, obviously people with good combat skills, organized them in a covert manner in Paris, got them weapons and equipment of high quality, especially the suicide vest that they had there, and then they carried out an attack which was very well planned.
Well, and what we're learning as we learn more about these terrorists, including the man we were just talking about, there was a pretty extensive profile of him in the New York Times today. He was involved in the drug trade. He sounds like he was involved in some petty crime as well. He spent time in prison. Not the profile of a particularly pious or religious person.
No, and if you look at some of the backstories of many members who join ISIS, many of them are dispossessed young men who may have gone to prison, and at some point they became radicalized, found Islam, and then found that they couldn't live within the confines of traditional Islam, which emphasizes respect and tolerance. And they went over to radical Islam. What ISIS ideology, which stems from Al-Qaeda, their parent organization's ideology, is actually an apocalyptic Islamic cultic vision. And which has manifested in Islam before. As a matter of fact, it's happened four times in Islam, and ISIS and Al-Qaeda ideology is the fifth manifestation of cultism. And I say it's cultism because the belief systems inside that group are so un-Islamic as to be almost anti-Islamic. They don't believe that tolerance and respect, art, culture, and all history of Islam since the 7th century is applicable to them. And they view the rest of the world as their oyster, and that they have the right to kill and take what they please. And none of this is Islamic. So this inspires these young men. For some strange reason, they adhere to this cultic ideology, and they thrive on the fact that they can become something almost immediately where everybody else has to earn that. And these men seem to find Al-Qaeda ideology as so appealing that they're willing to give their lives for it happily.
Malcolm, do you think that what appeals to them is the chance to kill people and kill lots of people, that there's something attractive, especially thinking about what happened on Friday night? You've got people, young people out enjoying a beautiful evening in Paris. These are, quote unquote, soft targets. Is there something appealing about the sort of murderousness that happened that night?
Like most cults, you know, this is a mind control ideology. And what they do is they take this traditional religion, and then what they do is they excise it of all of its ability to show restraint and to show respect. And in doing that, that empowers them with belief that they and themselves are acting as God's own weapon systems. And in doing that, they're told repeatedly that they can take what they want, but their real rewards won't come on this earth. Their real rewards will come in paradise. And the only way that you can be a respected member of this group is to actually act as all other members of this group does, and that anyone who is not within that group themselves is an apostate, is a kufr, an infidel. Therefore, they have the right to kill anyone, including Muslims, especially Muslims, because Muslims who don't join their group themselves are considered heretics, apostates, and subject to summary execution. And that is very appealing to a subset of people.
And the appeal of suicide, a woman, you know, killed herself this morning using an explosive vest. What is the appeal of suicide? What does that mean?
Well, I bring it back to the ideology. They believe that Islam is not comprised of five pillars, you know, of charity, fasting, Hajj, and they believe that there are two additional pillars to Islam, which no Muslim believes in. They believe that you must be engaged in a jihad, a struggle, the lesser struggle, a defensive jihad for the remainder of your life. And in that jihad, you must die in order to please God. Therefore, if you buy into the ideology, everyone, every moment of your existence within what they call jihad zone, it's imbued in you that your highest calling is to die, and to die in martyrdom by killing the enemies of their cultic brand of Islam. And that's why you have women who do this. And she's not the first woman to carry out a suicide attack for this ideology. We had Muriel Degac, who was a Belgian Catholic who from Charleroi in Belgium. And she joined Al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2004 and did a tactic that we discovered in Iraq called husband and wife suicide bombings, where they would get in cars right next to each other and drive down and strike two targets simultaneously and go to paradise together. And we've seen many types of these attacks with Al-Qaeda, and now ISIS is using, you know, the same tactic for the people in their group.
What I always find so interesting and disturbing is that you don't find the leaders killing themselves. It's the followers who are killing themselves. So how do you, you know, lead an apocalyptic cult that believes in murder and suicide, but the leaders don't commit suicide?
It's a mean trick, isn't it?
It is a mean trick.
To a certain extent, you know, sort of like the way that the communists, the Marxist-Leninists, believed that there was a communist elite who had to lead the organization and who couldn't, indulge in the same lifestyle as the proletariat. This cult has a cultic elite. They have a jihadi elite. And for an organization that really thrives on the blessedness of dying in a suicide martyrdom attack and killing their enemies, they do have this upper tier of personnel who don't do that. But for the most part, that upper tier has fought themselves through many, many battles, and they have the respect of the jihadis. But of course, someone who, you know, some of the senior commanders of ISIS started out in 2003, 2004 in Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or as part of Saddam Fedayeen commando forces. And because they fought so long and so hard, they moved up the chain of command, and then they have the ability to send lesser personnel, as we say in the intelligence community, and marry them up with a bomb and send them right out. So it's true. The commanders don't take this course. But when they are martyred, when they're killed in combat action, the hagiography is absolutely astounding. I mean, they write entire books and sing nasheed poetry about them. And that's the way that they gain their honor.
Is it also appropriate to think of them as cowards? And I ask that because, again, they targeted unarmed civilians, young people enjoying a concert, enjoying dinner. When we hear about what they are doing in the Middle East with, you know, raping children, raping women, beheading people, is that the behavior of a coward?
Let me give you an analogy that I think most people can understand from popular culture. At one time, there was a movie called Apocalypse Now, and it was about a rogue army colonel who took indigenous forces and started behaving in a manner that which was inconsistent with humanity, but was effective. ISIS and Al-Qaeda's ideology views the effect of terror as shock value to attack their enemies, and they feel that everyone who is outside of their immediate organization, and that includes all Muslims, every person outside of their immediate organization is a non-believer. And all non-believers in what they call the abode of war, Dar al-Harb, or the abode of the unclean, Dar al-Kufr, they believe that these people who are not one of them are their enemies, and all enemies must die, and they must die at the hands of their mujahideen, and preferably the mujahideen must die himself while striking a blow at his enemy in order to please God. Hmm. And that's what this, none of this exists in Islam as a mainstream ideology at all. It's only manifested itself a few times, despite the fact that there are some precepts in the Quran. This is very, very un-Islamic, to the point that it's anti-Islamic, because Muslims are their first targets.
Malcolm, hold on to your thoughts, only because we have to take a very short break. That's Malcolm Nance. He's executive director of Tapestry. We are talking about the mind of a terrorist, and you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Malcolm Nance. He's the executive director of Tapestry. He's a counterterrorism and intelligence consultant. He wrote a book called The Terrorist Recognition Handbook, and he's got a new book coming out called Defeating ISIS. And again, you can join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Malcolm, I've heard a couple of people say that what happened in Paris, as horrifying as it is a sign of desperation from ISIS. Apparently, there have been some losses on the battlefield. Some of these drone and bomb strikes are having some kind of impact on this organization. Do you think there's some truth to that?
Yes, I believe that there is some truth to that. However, you know, we've been down this road before, and as horrific as Paris was, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this is not the first terrorist attack in Europe. This is not even the worst terrorist attack in Europe. The Spanish suffered 191 dead in the Madrid train bombings of 2004. The British were attacked. The Russians lost two aircraft to suicide bombers just a few years ago. But one thing that we should say, that combat actions that are occurring in Iraq and Syria are the equivalent of us stepping on a ball of mercury. And that's just the nature of terrorism. You squeeze down on it, it spreads out, it breaks up into pieces. And when you lift that you know, lift the pressure off of it, it rolls back and it becomes a cohesive organization. And the trick is learning how to, you know, squash that mercury and mop it up. And so, yes, to a certain extent, striking out in Paris is a measure of desperation, but it's also a way of changing the narrative and the strategic dynamic, as you see.
Well, let me look at the title of your forthcoming book, Defeating ISIS. Is it a matter of defeating them on the battlefield, although if it's like that, mercury can pop up in other forms in other parts of the world? Is it a matter of hearts and minds? If this is a cult that uses propaganda and is kind of brainwashing people, is it a hearts and minds approach?
Well, as a matter of fact, I wrote another book in 2010 called An End to Al-Qaeda, and it was a full-scale strategic study of counter-ideology warfare. And that's where you go after the ideology, you go after the belief system of this cultic group. And it's a clear study of the historic precedents that have given them this cult and where other cults occurred in Islam and how they were quashed. And so there's two components to this. You do have to empower the Muslim world to stand up against this and to break that ideology through the use of respect and tolerance of traditional Islam by the 1.5 billion Muslims. And it's something that we don't do now, is we claim that the Muslim world is not acting against this. They're not shouting this down. But in fact, they actually are shouting it down. The Western media just doesn't hear it. What we need to do is empower them to actually disenfranchise these people spiritually as well as materially, so that the water sellers of Raqqa will have to fear for their souls if they keep going with this group, as opposed to being a good traditional Muslim. So they keep getting a pass by the Muslim world and by the West. And the West allows us in the media to say that these people speak for Islam, when in fact they are truly, truly not Islamic in any way, shape, or form. And on the other hand, we have a special operations strategy, which is asymmetrical in itself, that is just not being done. We need to marry up our special operations forces, the existing ones that are there, with Iraqi Free Syrian Army and Kurdish forces, but use them in such a way that you defeat the borders of ISIS, which is do large-scale night raids behind the lines of ISIS's cities and on the highways between the cities, and destroy everything that moves for an 8 to 10 hour period, get on the transport and disappear. These kind of traditional asymmetric operations, which are the hallmark of the U.S. Army Rangers and the Special Forces, aren't being done. So if you get into ISIS's terrain, as opposed to just fighting them head-to-head and bashing your head, outside Ramadi and outside Fallujah, you should fly 150 miles behind the lines to Fallujah and bring Iraqi Army Special Forces, who are very good, across the border into Deir ez-Zor, Syria, because there is no border in ISIS. There's only highways that connect little pockets of ISIS's main forces. So destroy those links on the highway, and that will completely change the narrative.
Oh, my goodness. We are having such technical problems this morning. We're going to call him back. That's Malcolm Nance. He's the executive director of the Terror Asymmetrics Project on Strategy, Tactics, and Radical Ideologies, known as TAPSTRI. The first of two guests in this hour of Radio Times talking about what many people are talking about since the terror attacks in Paris last Friday night, trying to understand the mind of terrorists, the ideology that seems so attractive to a certain segment of the population. And Malcolm Nance talking about the kinds of forces needed in the parts of the world that ISIS does control. Malcolm Nance, do we have you back on Radio Times?
Yes. Yes, you do. And I have extra time for you.
Oh, that's good. Let me just ask you a quick question here, because it sounds like what you're saying is, and I've heard people calling saying it's time, you know, to send in 200,000, 300,000 military, perhaps Americans, perhaps a regional force to essentially, you know, fight ISIS on the ground. You seem to be saying use the special ops that the Iraqis have, that the U.S. has, and do a much more sort of targeted stealth attack on ISIS.
Absolutely. We cannot get back into a major land war in Iraq or Syria. I mean, we had 125,000 combat support troops, total air supremacy, total mid-level helicopter domination of the battle space. And we fought them for 8 years nonstop, lost approximately 4,900 soldiers, and still did not defeat the group. The group is an asymmetric organization, which means that they use judo. When you throw your weight, they flip you. You have to do the same thing to them. And so creating an international and pan-Arab special operations task group, marrying that up with U.S. special operations soldiers who will advise them and give them forward air control on a scale of, let's say, one U.S. soldier for every five Iraqi, Kurdish, or Free Syrian Army soldiers, and don't just fight these traditional linear battles. Get way behind ISIS's lines. Surround Raqqa along the major highways every night until their forces come out to meet you, destroy them with air power, destroy whatever logistics are on the highway, and then get on your transport and disappear. We've done this many, many times, but things are going so linearly right now that ISIS is able to maintain the nominal belief that they have a border system, when in fact all they have are these cities that are connected by highways. Take control of the highways for 8 hours, 10 hours, 24 hours, 72 hours, and let them know that they only control their little isolated pockets of populations.
How do you think there have been calls in Europe, also in this country as well, to close borders, to reject refugees, to essentially say no? Many of these refugees, of course, coming from Syria. How does that play out among people who ascribe to ISIS's ideology?
To be quite honest, these calls are playing right into their hands. It is just astounding to me that after 14 years of almost continuous combat since 9/11, that we have not figured out that when you reject the traditional Muslim world, when you insult the traditional Muslim world, when you even not allow children to come to your shores, that you're driving them into the hands of the terrorist groups themselves. If 10,000 Syrians were come to the United States and the president had asked me, he said, Malcolm, what would you do? I would say, Mr. President, I need to recruit 10,000 translators. I need to recruit people who can work in support of the special operations in the intelligence community. I need to offer every one of them a job, man, woman, and of course, we can get them child care. So these people could become model American citizens. I believe that that passport was planted operationally from a tradecraft perspective. I cannot see any reason for that passport to have been found there other than making them want to believe. And you have to understand, the ISIS's intelligence organization is Saddam Hussein's intelligence organization. 40 years of KGB and internal Stasi-like controls, and they run ISIS's intelligence, and they're very, very smart. And they know how to pull our chains. So these calls for keeping refugees out, it's not only un-American and dishonorable, but in fact, you may be excluding assets that could be game changers for our intelligence and special operations community.
We hear about ISIS able to get revenue, whether from oil or even robbing banks, things like that. Are they a well-funded organization?
Well, they certainly are now. I mean, after they took the central bank in Mosul and they managed to co-opt all of the illicit activities of the Iraqi tribes, including oil smuggling, now antiquity smuggling, or selling blood antiquities by essentially extorting every person who lives under their heel. So ISIS funds itself through every manner of criminal activity. They are a massive continuing criminal enterprise. And so they have the ability to make millions and millions of dollars. I just saw a report the other day, which came with a photo from Egypt, where the ISIS forces in the Sinai Peninsula were being paid in $10,000 bundles of $100 bills.
Dollar bills.
And the money market for them is very fluid. And what we need to do, again, is use all military, diplomatic, political, and intelligence, law enforcement, levers right now and truly declare war on them. No one should be making any money off of this group. Any asset that they have, like those oil transports, we need to destroy them and destroy them permanently.
You describe them as a cult, a criminal enterprise. Is it helpful to think of them as some kind of organized crime syndicate?
Well, they actually operate like the mafia. You know, they have omerta, you know, the law of not speaking about what you're doing. They meet face to face. They have no fear of being turned in by their fellow people. They routinely execute each other. But I want to go back to this apocalyptic cult.
Sure.
You know, there have been other terrorist groups like this. Aum Shinrikyo, the Japanese terror cult, which was half Christian, half Buddhist, half made up spiritual, hired some of the greatest minds in Japan and created nerve gas and used it in Japan. You know, the Branch Davidians, you know, 100 people with fully automatic weapons set fire to themselves. They all corrupt these mainstream religions, and they all have political and personal agendas. ISIS, I could go down ISIS's mind control checklist from some of the experts, and it is no different than the Manson family. So, and again, it's manifested itself before in Islam, and it's appealing to a certain subset of people with psychological defects.
Well, Malcolm Nance, we could go on. I do apologize for the technical problems. I really appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
It is my pleasure to be here, although I wish under better circumstances.
Me as well. And that's Malcolm Nance, Executive Director of the Terror Asymmetrics Project on Strategy, Tactics, and Radical Ideologies, also known as TAPSTRI. He's got a forthcoming book called Defeating ISIS. Well, the terror attacks in Paris last week have raised some questions about the relationship between France and its Muslim communities. There are 5 million Muslims living in France and the largest source of recruits for ISIS in Western Europe. But when you look at the per capita figures, it's the same or even less than other European countries. We asked Jonathan Lawrence to join us. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Boston College, a non-resident senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. Wrote a book called The Emancipation of Europe's Muslims. And Jonathan Lawrence, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Why has France been such a magnet for Muslims looking for a European country to live in?
Well, France has a long history of intervention in the Arab world, going back to Napoleon's expedition to Egypt in 1798, where the French stayed for 3 years. France became a colonial power in North Africa in the 19th century. It eventually annexed Algeria in the 1840s, which remained French until 1962. It also served as the protector or mandate giver for Morocco and Tunisia, Lebanon, Syria. So there is a long French history in the region. And when France, after the Second World War, needed labor migrants to help reconstruct the country, they came from the natural, obvious source right on the other side of the Mediterranean, North Africa and principally Algeria.
You say the early on approaches, I guess, would be 70s, 80s, 90s in France was ennui, indifference, a kind of indifference to the Muslims who would move to that country to work. Indifference, why and how?
Well, I wouldn't say indifference so much as a kind of mutual decision to delay resolving certain practical issues. The migrants who came to France in the 1960s and even into the 1970s were largely single male workers who would rotate in and out. They didn't necessarily intend to stay, and France didn't necessarily want them to stay. There were actually programs devised by the foreign ministry to create Arabic language programming, Arabic instruction in public schools. And this was for the children of these migrant workers to eventually return home, so to speak, at a given time. Now, clearly, between the population going from single male workers to having children in schools, something happened in between, right. And that was the family reunification policy of the 1970s. But all of this happened in a kind of unplanned manner, And Muslims didn't really emerge as a community of any kind until really the 1980s or the 1990s. And it turns out that French political life isn't especially friendly to the notion of community, yet it's precisely that which the Muslim religion is lacking right now and which has left it so vulnerable to some of these toxic ideologies.
And are you saying, about a minute before our break here, but are you saying that these toxic ideologies kind of filled a void that was left in France as these communities were not integrated into the larger society?
Yes, to a certain extent. I mean, we shouldn't overstate the degree of or the proportion of Muslims involved in this activity. It's really 0.03%. So it's not like we can generalize the entire French Muslim scene. But it's true that there is an institutional void in terms of religious education, imams and theologians who are based in France, who can, you know, plausibly and credibly refute these ideologies. And that's a result of, you know, the complex French history and its relationship with organized religion, as much as it is, a sort of blowback from the colonial era.
Well, we are talking about the complicated relationship between France and its Muslim community. And again, our guest is Jonathan Lawrence from Boston College. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and you can join the conversation, shifting gears slightly from our first guest. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Did you grow up in a chaotic household or live with someone who abused drugs or alcohol? Over 60% of Americans grow up experiencing some type of household dysfunction, abuse, or neglect. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness supports WHYY and is seeking menopausal women between the ages of 48 and 60 who experienced a stressful or chaotic childhood to participate in a study examining how early life stress affects memory later in life. Study participation includes brain imaging, blood draws, and memory tests. More information by contacting Claudia at 215-41-STUDY.
I'm Marty Moscoen. Coming up on Radio Times, a trip down memory lane, we'll be talking about the appeal of nostalgia and why we sometimes long for the good old days, plus the genius of Michael Jackson. That's at 11, right here on WHYY. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Jonathan Lawrence about the relationship, sometimes fraught and complicated relationship, between France and its Muslim community. Again, he's Associate Professor of Political Science at Boston College, also a non-resident senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, and he wrote a book called The Emancipation of Europe's Muslims. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Jonathan, you've written about something called laïcité, L-A-I-C-I-T-E. Can you define that and tell us why that's important to talk about?
Yes, that's basically the French word for secularism. And what it means is that the public sphere should be devoid of religious symbols and as neutral as possible. Now, there's a slight misconception that this equals an automatic hostility to religion. It does not. French policies are actually somewhat generous towards recognize religious communities such as Catholics, Protestants, and Jews, and they've started to be so with Muslims as well. But a hallmark policy of laïcité would be the headscarf legislation in 2003-2004, which sought to preserve the neutrality of public schools, and so prohibited the wearing of headscarves, of large crosses, of kippahs. And that is sort of the idea, to avoid divisions within the French nation and to avoid sort of breaking up into communities. There have been important moments in French history when that pact between the state and organized religion has been adapted or adjusted. Really each century, once with the Catholics, once with the Jews, once with the Protestants. And what we're experiencing right now, really the throes of that process that's ongoing with the historic settlement of Muslims in France.
And I guess the idea a generation or two ago is that these people would be here temporarily and then go back home, but obviously that didn't happen.
Well, French citizenship is granted to all who are born on French soil, so there can't be too much naivete about the absolutely unanticipated nature of this. This isn't like Germany, where they were explicitly called guest workers, where they were kept out of citizenship and out of the franchise for 50 years. France granted rights immediately and thought that it could integrate them into its model of citizenship. And for the vast, vast majority, of course, this has largely happened and worked to the same extent that it has for other immigrant groups. But right now, the geopolitics of Islam and the lack of religious authority leave this large population of Muslims in France vulnerable to the, a volatile world.
Do you think the American model, apparently we do a better job of integrating people into society, and we do have, we're not particularly secular. We're a much more overtly religious country. Is that a better model for a country like France?
Well, it's not the sort of thing that one can easily import or export because it's so tied into specific historical events. The American conception of religious freedom really is about freedom from state interference in religion. That's, the myth of the arrival of the pilgrims and of our founding fathers, et cetera. For French, it's really the opposite. It was about removing religion from politics. And in particular, throwing off the rule of the Catholic Church in a country that was 99% Catholic in the French Revolution. And that set in course basically 225 years of a very fraught relationship with organized religion. There have been periods of intense anti-clericalism. And you could say, in a sense, that this is simply the latest wave.
But do you think the fact that there isn't this same kind of integration of other religious groups in France, and that's we're talking about France, obviously, because that's where the attacks took place on Friday night, that because there isn't this integration, that allows a kind of radicalization, even of a very small, tiny segment of the population?
Well, clearly, that is what has happened. But I think that this is something the state has taken seriously for at least the last 25 years or so, basically since the first Gulf War, when the government first tried to help Muslims organize their own religious life, which meant facilitating the construction of prayer spaces, the ritual slaughter at festival time, even the beginnings of imam training, although not in the full form that's necessary. So it's not that the French state does not know religious communities or know religion. It has mechanisms and tools to engage Islam as a religion. It just hasn't fully deployed them to the extent that it has for its historically present religions, Catholicism, Protestantism, and Judaism. And that's understandable. It's a recent arrival. And these things take time. So it's not that the French model is unable to digest religious communities. It just has a certain political culture that is less friendly to God talk, if you like, in the public sphere, and that requires a very sort of explicit pact with its religious citizens that they will leave their sacred texts at home.
So what happens next, do you think? And obviously this is a situation very much in flux. There was a raid on an apartment in a suburb of Paris this morning. Several people died, including a woman that blew herself up. If the goal is to try to address whatever is radicalizing these young people, what do you think France should do next?
Well, there is the short term and the long term. Right now, there's a state of emergency in France, which obviously is an extremely exceptional situation. And the Interior Ministry is using this to close the mosques that are known to be hotbeds of radicalism. Now, these are prayer spaces, usually Salafists, that have not broken any laws. but where French tolerance is simply going to end. Already after January's attacks, they had begun to block internet sites unilaterally. Now there's talk of criminalizing even the visiting of certain internet sites. Mm-hmm. So there's a series of sort of short-term repressive measures, identifying and better surveilling known radicals and the like. But there's a longer-term project which has to do with keeping a vacuum from forming again within French Islam. And this is really a broader European challenge. The arrival of Muslims in Europe just happened to coincide with a kind of a secularization trend within European societies themselves. So there's a kind of awkward interaction with these communities who have arrived from far more religious societies, where religion is plays a far greater role in public life. Now, many of these European countries are used to integrating waves of immigrants. They had problems in the past, and they surmounted them. And I think there's no reason to believe that that won't also be the case this time.
But as we all know, we've got refugees fleeing from Syria, other parts of the Middle East coming into Europe. Some of the countries basically, if not closing their borders, at least a temporary halt on the flood of those refugees. How do we factor, and I assume, you know, many of them or perhaps most of them are Muslims. How do we factor that into our discussion?
Well, that, I think, was an emergency humanitarian crisis where countries like Germany and Sweden really stepped up and took on a great responsibility by accepting hundreds of thousands of surprise arrivals. And that was, I think, a great humanitarian gesture. The longer term question, of course, is what residential and citizenship status such refugees should eventually acquire. It is potentially destabilizing to have such a large population, such a large influx all of a sudden, overnight, into these Muslim minorities, say in Germany, for example, which is just starting to reach a certain comfort level institutionally and politically. And so there is a potential setback there. That doesn't mean that temporary asylum can't be granted. The Germans did so with Bosnian Muslims in the 1990s, accepting hundreds of thousands of them during the civil war in Yugoslavia. And in fact, it managed to send back 150,000 of them in the late 1990s. So once peace had returned to Bosnia-Herzegovina. Now, that is, as peace talks are ongoing in Syria, certainly a potential possibility to keep in mind.
But doesn't Europe also need immigrants? It needs population because of its demographics.
Yes, of course, but that should really take place in a more orderly fashion. This is not a panacea to European demographic problems. Certainly, there are going to be professionals amongst these refugees who would be immediately economically productive. And I think that there will be screening programs to a certain extent to especially find a way to welcome those who are going to be so-called productive members of society. Right now, the political climate in Germany and other countries would not be particularly favorable to the notion of so-called freeloading refugees or asylum applicants.
Is that the word they use, freeloading?
Well, I mean, that word is used, I'm sure, on the comments section of many websites. But it's not entered the lexicon of the political class. Other metaphors have, including that of an avalanche, which the finance minister Schäuble used to describe the influx of refugees, and that was a way of signaling, a real sense of alarm among German politicians, especially those in the center-right party. That there is a kind of gathering anti-refugee sentiment that could wind up punishing them electorally.
Let me get James from Chester County to join us. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I just want to reiterate the colonialistic past of France is really plays a major factor. I was married to a French woman who was Pinois. They're repatriated from Algeria after the war, after de Gaulle gave it back, and they had an open disdain for Muslims and just like Le Pen and that whole thing. It's just so apparent that I was just wondering if the aging population of Pinoir had any kind of a real effect but I was just. Sure. Want to read that comment.
No, James, thanks for the call to Radio Times. He talks about the disdain. Jonathan, is that how real, how common is that?
I wouldn't say it's common, but it's a factor in French political life. There is a party known as the National Front, which has, since the 1970s, been contesting elections. Its leader, Jean-Marie Le Pen, is an internationally known far-right figure, and his daughter has since taken over. Now, the National Front was actually created with the full name, the National Front for French Algeria. That is to say, it was highly tightly intertwined with the colonial enterprise and did not want to give up Algeria at any cost, and considered de Gaulle's surrender of Algeria to the FLN to be unacceptable. So the far right actually started off as this kind of irredentist and as the caller referred to, you know, hateful political force. Now, over time, it has matured and it has become not quite a mainstream party, but certainly one that is much more present in public discussions, that is much more successful in elections. And while it's far from, you know, winning more than a handful of parliamentary seats, the nature of French presidential elections means that, you know, a personally popular candidate such as Marine Le Pen can get into the final round of the elections with just 19 or 20% of the vote.
I'm looking at a piece you wrote about a year ago for Brookings called French Jihad Movements and Jewish Flight. Are Jews leaving France?
Jews have left France at a much higher rate in the last 2 years, 3 years, at a rate of around perhaps 1% or so of the Jewish population has left each year. Now, some of them have returned. It's not all permanent emigration. Some of them are going and you know, taking advantage of the Israeli government's generous welcome packages. And then if they're finding a job, they're staying. If they're not, they're sometimes returning. But the climate for French Jews just started to decline during the Second Intifada already in 2000. And the French government responded, you know, over really a 10-year period to try and address the root causes of the anti-Semitism in the banlieue, which had already, of course, produced a handful of massacres. By 2014, in 2012, there was a Frenchman who murdered Jewish children and school teachers in Toulouse. In 2014, there was another who murdered four visitors to the Jewish Museum in Brussels. In 2014, there were riots that took place in the Paris suburb of Sarcelles. And in which Jewish businesses were sacked. Now, these are isolated occurrences, but were extremely traumatic and indeed sent some French Jews into flight. Now, the vast majority obviously have decided that they won't be ethnically cleansed from their own country and have decided to stay.
Well, we could go on. We do have to end our conversation. Jonathan Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Boston College, a non-resident senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, and again wrote a book called The Emancipation of Europe's Muslims. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for a newsletter, and do stay with us for hour two, coming up right after this very short break.